It is well decided, and we agree, that students do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse door. However, it is equally well decided that those constitutional rights will be administered in a way that is sensitive to the school environment.
Welcome to the High School SCOTUS podcast, where we talk about how the decisions of the Supreme Court and the words of the Constitution play out behind the schoolhouse gate. I'm Elise Benner, a 15-year-old from the suburbs outside of San Francisco.
And I'm Hannah Saroff, a 17-year-old from Seattle, Washington.
For the next 6 months, we'll bring you an episode every other week about the Supreme Court, the Constitution, and the rights of students. We'll talk to legal experts, lawyers, and journalists as we learn along with you. Join us.
Today, we bring you the very first episode of the High School SCOTUS podcast, an interview with Jeffrey Rosen, the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, about the value of civic education, how to teach students about the Supreme Court, and how to make the law relevant to the people it impacts. Let's take a listen.
Hi, could you introduce yourself and just give some background on what you do and who you are?
Hi, everyone. I'm Jeffrey Rosen, the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, and I'm so glad to be here on the SCOTUS podcast and so looking forward to our conversation.
Awesome. Our next question has to do with you in high school. We want to know, were you a constitutional nerd in high school?
I was a nerd, absolutely. And I guess I was a constitutional nerd as well, although I focused more on literature and history than constitutional law. We didn't have a constitution class. I had spectacular history teachers, including Jeffrey Gund and Paul Poet, and magnificent English teachers, including Hortense Tiroler and Michael Berthold. And these phenomenal teachers at a school in New York City that I went to called Dalton completely kindled my love for history and literature and set the stage for everything that came after. High school was very, very important in my life. It was a wonderful school that encouraged creativity, individuality, following your own path, music, learning, wonderful friends. But I really need to express gratitude for my incredible high school teachers who set the stage for lots of light and learning.
I think Hannah and I will both say the same about our high school experience. When did you start to think of the Constitution as a document that you would spend the rest of your life studying and learning from?
So I always loved history and literature. And I continue that love in college, where I majored in English and government and studied American history and the Puritans and wrote about Henry Adams, a great figure in American history who struggled with his Puritan heritage and tried to make sense of life, 20th century America that he found unfamiliar. But none of this really involved the study of the Constitution. After college, I spent 2 years in England at Oxford University, where I studied philosophy and politics and economics. And then I went to law school really because I couldn't think of what else to do. Like many people, I just wanted to keep writing and learning, but had no special desire to be a lawyer. And in fact, when I started law school, I made a resolution that I wouldn't be a practicing lawyer, because I thought I wouldn't be good at it. And it wasn't what I really loved to do, which is what I love to do is read and write. And increasingly, I realized as I started law school, study the Constitution. Law school was another place where teachers made all the difference. And these spectacular teachers of the Constitution, in particular, Akhil, who I'm still very close to, as well as Bruce Ackerman and Lawrence Lessig and Owen Fiss and so many other great scholars, made me feel like the Constitution was the perfect merging of history and literature in a way that I found incredibly exciting and seemed to represent a kind of calling. I'd felt in college this calling to bring together history and literature in some way, but I didn't know how it would work. And in law school, I realized that the Constitution was the place to do it. But in order to follow that calling, I had to resist the urge to be a lawyer. And I kind of saw that many of my classmates said that they didn't want to practice law, but a couple of years out, most people were actually in law firms. So I made a decision in law school not to be a real lawyer. And managed to stick to that after graduation. I wasn't sure exactly what I'd do when I graduated, decided to be a journalist rather than a lawyer, because I thought that that would be a good way of writing about the law. And it wasn't exactly clear how that was going to happen. And then a huge stroke of luck occurred. I was clerking for a judge, and out of the blue, the editor of the New Republic magazine, whose name is Andrew Sullivan, he's still a great writer, just called out of the blue and said he wanted me to come to the New Republic and be their legal editor and write about law in the way that great writers like Felix Frankfurter and Alexander Bickel and Learned Hand had written for this magazine in the past. It was an unbelievable break. I'd been a summer intern there during law school, and that's partly how I got to know Andrew Sullivan. Also, I went to college with him, so there was an element of nepotism there. You know, I was lucky just to have been in the right place at the right time. But it was an incredible break, and so much followed from there. Just the opportunity to be the legal affairs editor of the New Republic magazine at the age of 28, right out of law school, and to write about the Supreme Court and the law at a time when there was no internet, and there weren't a lot of platforms to do this kind of writing, was a tremendous break. And I think it happened because I was strict with myself and wasn't in a law firm and decided to kind of follow this path. So that was a kind of risk combined with an unbelievable stroke of luck. And so much that followed came from that one big break.
This is jumping forward a little bit in your path, but we'd love some background. What do you do at the National Constitution Center?
Well, I have the best job in the world for someone who loves the Constitution, because I get to learn and teach and have conversations about the Constitution every day. The Constitution Center is a very special and unique American institution. It's a private nonprofit, but it was created by the U.S. Congress during the bicentennial of the Constitution around 1987 with a very inspiring mission, which you guys may know because I love to recite it at the beginning of all of our programs. And the mission of the National Constitution Center is to increase awareness and understanding of the American people about the U.S. Constitution on a nonpartisan basis. And that idea that there should be one place in America where people of different perspectives can convene for nonpartisan constitutional education and debate was an inspired idea by Congress. And thankfully, it was able to be created, because it's hard to imagine a similar institution being created today. The National Constitution Center is a very inspiring physical place. It's a sort of temple to the Constitution on Independence Mall in Philadelphia, across from Independence Hall, where the Constitution was drafted. It's this soaring, beautiful building designed by I.M. Pei with life-size statues of the American founders and the rarest original drafts of the Constitution written by James Wilson, one of the 12 original drafts of the Bill of Rights, live theater, beautiful exhibits, including about the Civil War and Reconstruction and the 19th Amendment. And just this week, we're about to open the First Amendment tablet on the Grand Overlook. There's a 50-foot tablet of the words of the First Amendment that weighs 75 tons. And it used to be in front of the Newseum building in Washington, D.C. And it's been meticulously reassembled at the National Constitution Center. And it's actually opening this week. I can't wait to see it. So it's so cool. I see you guys are as excited as I am. I mean, I would love to show it to you in person and to share it with all the listeners as well once it's open. So that's the physical space of the Constitution Center. And for much of its early years, the Constitution Center really thought of itself mostly as a museum of the Constitution on Independence Mall. When I started in 2013, we began to take seriously the other parts of the charter of the National Constitution Center, which are in a declaration of Congress. And that's to serve as America's leading center for nonpartisan education and debate. So we really ramped up the town halls, the public program, and also the educational components. And we're now America's leading online platform for constitutional education. So the core of what we do is called the Interactive Constitution. We launched it in 2015, and it's now gotten more than 55 million hits since we launched in 2015, and is one of the most Googled constitutions in the world. When you Google any provision of the Constitution, we're likely to come up top. What we started by doing was to bring together the leading liberal and conservative law professors in America to write about every clause of the Constitution, describing what they agree about and what they disagree about. And we were so excited that the Federalist Society and the American Constitution Society, which are the leading conservative and progressive lawyers organizations, co-sponsored this great project and nominated scholars to write about every clause. So you can find, for example, if you want to learn about the suspension of habeas corpus clause, now Justice Amy Coney Barrett and Neil Katyal, nominated by the Federalist Society and the American Constitution Society, with 1,000 words about what they agree the clause means, and then separate statements of about 1,000 words about what they disagree about. So multiply that by 80 clauses, and it's this extraordinary, shining, radiant collection of light and learning. Every time I dig into a new clause, I learn something new because there's so much to learn. And that model of exploring areas of agreement and disagreement in a respectful, civil way is one that we took to all of our other programs as we began to build out the Interactive Constitution. So you may know that we have this wonderful podcast called We the People that I host every week. And that's the same model. I invite a liberal and a conservative expert to talk about the constitutional issue of the week. It could be a current issue in the news, like just last week. Of course, we recorded the Supreme Court's oral argument about the vaccine mandate, and then the court handed down its decision yesterday. And as it happened, our guests, who convened the day before the oral argument, accurately predicted what the court would do, namely strike down the broad mandate that applied to 82 million people through the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, but uphold the other mandate. And they did that because we approach all of our issues from a constitutional and not a political point of view. We asked the guests to analyze the legal issues, to weigh their relevant weight, and to try to think about how the justices would approach them through a constitutional lens. And it turned out they were right about it. So that's another very, very meaningful opportunity for learning. I learn so much every time I host the conversation. And the point isn't really to have a kind of debate about who's right and who's wrong, but just to illuminate the issues, to help people make up their own mind by putting on the table the various approaches and how different people of different perspectives would approach it. And then finally, and I'll stop because I get so excited when I start talking about all the wonderful things I get to do. We launched during COVID a series of live online classes about the Constitution, Constitution 101 classes. We've reached 250,000 students, middle and high school students, during those first year and a half of live classes. And we're now creating online versions of it with great videos that we're recording now and excerpts from the Interactive Constitution. We're putting online a founder's library of great texts from American history, from the founding through Reconstruction, through the Civil Rights Movement, that'll be the basis for every class. And the texts are going to be selected by leading liberal and conservative historians to ensure they're nonpartisan as well. And it's so exciting. We're going to have this 15-week class that should be online later this year, which will be the basis for lots and lots of archive classes, which we hope will be the main place that people go for nonpartisan learning about the Constitution. So the web has just been an extraordinary opportunity to increase the reach and inspire learners of all backgrounds to join us in our great enterprise. And it's all part of our integrated mission of being America's leading education center for nonpartisan constitutional education and debate.
I noticed with all of your programs, you discussed the podcast, the Interactive Constitution, and the live lessons. You mentioned how it's important to approach it from like a constitutional basis rather than a policy one or a political one. And I wonder, what do you think is the power of introducing an alternative way of looking at legal issues than just, I'm a Republican, I'm going to go with the conservative view, or vice versa?
Thank you for noticing that and for asking about it, because it's the central framing that makes possible all the nonpartisan conversations we have. So this country obviously is extremely divided about politics. And if you took any political issue in the news, from gun control to abortion, it would be difficult to have a productive conversation about that because people of different perspectives are unlikely to persuade each other. They're really dug into their views and they're not going to change. But if you introduce a constitutional lens, suddenly everything changes. For example, if we were talking about gun control from a policy perspective, the question would be, is it a good or bad idea? If it's a constitutional perspective, the question is, does the Second Amendment allow or forbid it? And once you introduce that lens, then you introduce the possibility that people could reach a constitutional conclusion that differs from their political views. You might think gun control is a great idea, but the Second Amendment forbids it, or it's a terrible idea, but the Constitution allows it. In order to have an informed opinion about a constitutional and not a political issue, you've got to do some learning. You have to start by reading the relevant text. Then you have to talk about the paradigm cases in history that gave rise to the text. Then you have to study what the Supreme Court has said about the question, including not only the majority opinions, but also the dissents. And then you have to try to think about how to apply all of these important learnings about text, history, structure, precedent to current situations, often involving new technology and situations that the founders didn't think about. That's a lot of work to do. So just in order to dig into all of that learning, that's going to turn down the partisan heat, introduce a bit of humility, encourage people to listen to views that they might disagree with, mostly just encourage people to open their minds and learn. I feel like I can't have an informed opinion about any of the issues we're discussing until I've heard from both sides, because they're usually cutting edge issues. And I'm trying to encourage learners of all ages to do the same thing. When I teach constitutional law and I teach a class at GW Law School, I do the same thing, saying that this is the rule of the class. Separate politics from your constitutional views. Let's ask not what the government should do, but what the Constitution allows or forbids it to do. This term at GW, we taught the abortion cases as the Supreme Court was deciding them. And, you know, again, it's hard to think of a more politically contested question than abortion, but we had a very respectful, deep, rich series of discussions trying to help everyone figure out what they thought as a constitutional matter. So I'm a real evangelist for this lens of constitutional discussions, not political discussions. I think at this particular moment in American history, the country is so terribly polarized politically. Even our discussion of how to study American history has become polarized. For us at the Constitution Center, we found that the solution is to lift the debate above partisanship and ideology and to focus on areas of constitutional agreement and disagreement. And that's exactly what we're trying to do.
That's incredible. So up until students take AP government, in 12th grade, discussion of the Supreme Court and the Constitution is kind of limited to memorizing amendments. And we think about the Supreme Court as the branch that interprets the laws. So how do we change curriculum to better educate students on the role of Supreme Court in their lives and in determining their rights?
Well, I would love the advice of you and all of your great listeners about how to do that. Our big crusade at the Constitution Center right now is to persuade schools, middle and high schools, to adopt our great curriculum. It's all free and online, and it's increasingly robust. And as I said, later this year, we're going to have this full 15-week class. So anyone who wants to use it can, and it includes materials for teachers, including questions and exercises so that it's easy to adopt either as part of the curriculum or as supplementary material that you can just plug into existing classes. So it's just a distribution challenge to persuade teachers to adopt this great free material. And as you say, the challenge is real because the existing curriculum doesn't really have a constitutional slot in it. Often, constitution laws is often a separate class. It's an elective. It's something that some schools offer, but it's not part of the core curriculum. So a lot of our work over the next couple of years will be to try to persuade schools to integrate this material. It does help schools meet the civics requirements that many states have. We're at a moment in our history where the civics debate has become very, very politically polarized, and it's encouraging to see that schools, parents, teachers, students of different perspectives, liberals and conservatives, are turning to the Constitution Center for a nonpartisan solution to their civics needs. So I'm optimistic that we can do it, but it's going to be a sprint requiring many co-evangelists or foot soldiers in this great crusade to persuade schools and teachers to adopt the material, and would love any teachers who are listening to this podcast who want to adopt our material, I hope they'll contact us at the Constitution Center, either me, Jeff Rosen, or our great head of education, Curry Sautner, a dynamic educator, who not only will help arrange our one-to-many classes, but we even have private exchanges where we can connect Constitution Center scholars to individual classrooms for discussions. But we'd love your help. And there's a lot of work to do. It's so great that the internet allows us to make all this stuff available free. And I hope that by the 250th birthday of America in 2026, we'll move from 250,000 kids, which is what we reached live just on Zoom during our first year, to many, many multiples of that.
I think it can be worrisome when I will read a Supreme Court opinion that seems like a very contentious case or important case, and then I'll go to school and I feel like everyone is oblivious to what's going on in that case, or the teachers shy away from talking about it in class because they're worried it's going to devolve into like a partisan debate. And how do we engage students so that they understand that what's going on at the Supreme Court is relevant to their struggles and their rights and what they can do in the future? How do we make sure they pay attention?
Well, first of all, it's so wonderful that you and your colleagues are doing this, and you recognize the importance of the work and also the ability of high school students to engage with it very rigorously. What you're doing is the ultimate expression of citizenship. You're doing what, you know, all what adults should be doing as well, which is when a Supreme Court decision comes down, to actually read it. And what a radical act that is. You can't really, as we all know, have an informed decision about the decision that the Supreme Court handed down yesterday involving vaccine mandates unless you read the decision. And you have to read the majority opinion and you have to read the dissents. And we know that that takes some confidence, especially if you're not a lawyer. There's some legal jargon and you have to not get caught up in that. And you also have to learn the skills of not maybe reading every single word, but reading strategically so you can get the core issue. That's the real skill that people learn in law school, and we're trying to teach at the Constitution Center. What's the core of the holding? So it turned out yesterday that the core of the legal dispute turned on the meaning of two words. In the occupational safety case, the governing statute authorized the agency to regulate employment, but not, according to the Supreme Court, health more generally. And in the case involving Medicare and Medicaid workers, the question, the authorization was to regulate the administration of the Medicaid program. And there, the Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh joined the liberals in holding that mandating vaccines for healthcare workers was relevant to administration in a way that mandating vaccines for workers more broadly was not relevant to threats to workplace safety specifically related to the employment context. So that, you know, and there was disagreement among the liberals and conservatives about what those words meant. It took me, what, about a minute to explain the differences between those two points. I did a little TV spot on the cases yesterday. You don't have them when you're talking on TV. I think you have about 15 seconds, and I think I was able to say it all turns on the meaning of the word and the difference between the word administration and employment or something like that. But the point is, much of the challenge is encouraging people to take time, just to take time to read the primary sources, not to make a snap judgment, not to assume that the majority struck down the mandates because they were conservative and the dissenters wanted to uphold it because they were liberal, but to actually engage the legal arguments on their own terms. And to do that, you gotta actually engage with the substance of the arguments, which takes a little work. So I think that's the task for all of us who are crusaders for the value of constitutional education, just to encourage our friends, and that you do that. Certainly, you can start doing that by just talking to your friends about these cases in legal terms and help them understand it. And they're not going to understand it intuitively, but say, hey, this was really an interesting dispute and it turned on what the meaning of the word administration is. And developing the skill, when I was a journalist, a great editor once told me, gave me really good advice about writing. He said, write it like you're telling it to someone over dinner. You know, if you're having dinner with someone or lunch, you got about 15 seconds to kind of, in very colloquial terms that everyone can understand, get to the point. And you don't have to dumb things down, or you can talk about complicated issues, but you've got to do it clearly and you have to kind of get to the heart of the matter. And that skill is key to good teaching. It's key to good writing. And it can be key to getting your friends excited about the Constitution. And that's why this podcast that you are running is so important, because I know that this is exactly what you're going to be doing on this podcast. So it's, and the other reason it's such an important act of citizenship is we live in such an age of sound bites and tweets. And one of the great threats to civic dialogue in America is that people are not taking the time to deliberate. And they're also not taking the time to read deeply. And I'll share with you a very sobering, poignant exchange I had with my dear teacher, Akhil Amar. I was interviewing him on one of our programs recently about his great new book, The Words That Made Us, which is, I think, right behind me on the bookshelf, which I really recommend to everyone. It's such an amazing book of constitutional history. And I said, Akhil, you know, the standard of debate was so high in the founding era, and ordinary citizens were debating the meaning of the writs of assistance in the newspapers and in broadsides. Why is the standard of debate on Twitter and Facebook so much lower? And he said, Jeff, you know, the problem is that people don't read anymore. They're not taking the time to read books. Even my students, he teaches at Yale Law School, you know, his brilliant students, the most privileged law students in America, he said, are not taking the time to read as much as people used to, because there's so many distractions on these screens and all of this browsing and tweeting and so forth. And I kind of choked up when Akhil told me that, because I thought, if those incredibly brilliant, privileged students are not taking the time to read, then how can we expect fellow citizens with far less advantages to take the time to read? But I am a great believer that if people are inspired by great teachers and by just by their friends to read, they'll come to see both how exciting it is to read and learn, and also how necessary it is to have an informed opinion about anything. So that's part of the job. And I'm so excited that you on this great podcast are going to be part of this great crusade.
Yeah, I read Professor Amar's book recently and it was amazing. It was thick, but it was amazing. And so everyone should read it, related to what you're talking about. But I guess kind of connected to that, how do we make sure that our conversations around the Constitution and the Supreme Court are rooted in stories and people rather than the technical legal jargon that can confuse people, like you were talking about?
That is a crucial point. First of all, that's wonderful that you read Professor Amar's book. Thank you for doing that. And you're a great testament to the fact that you don't have to be a lawyer. You can take a really long book and read it and learn from it and love it, because it includes not just technical legal jargon, but stories. As you said, people learn through stories. That's the way we get excited about stuff. And Akhil Amar is brilliant at telling stories about the human beings behind those great battles, like the writs of assistance and James Otis, who was an incredible lawyer and advocate of abolishing slavery, but also had a very poignant personal story. He kind of had some mental disturbances and became increasingly erratic in his behavior, and eventually insulted British officers so much that one of them, a British customs officer, took a cane and hit him over the head. And after that, he became completely unhinged and would go running through the Massachusetts legislature, you know, yelling uncontrollably, and finally kind of died tragically. And his mantle was taken over by his brilliant sister, Mercy Otis Warren, who John Adams called the poetical genius of the Revolution, who wrote these incredible poems about liberty and virtue, which we can all read, and which she viewed as both carrying on her brother's legacy and established her own genius in her own right. So already I've just told you those stories, and I'm sure we all want to learn more about James Otis and Mercy Otis Warren and what their relationship to John Adams was. So it's part of our job as teachers and students of the Constitution to tell these legal debates through historical stories. So at the Constitution Center, we have three pillars of our teaching method. The first is historical storytelling, just to get people excited about this. The second is teaching people to separate their political from their constitutional views. And the third is introducing different perspectives so people can have civil dialogue. And to try to do all that is a lot, but you can do it. And in these videos we're creating, I'm trying to start each one off with a story and then introduce the legal issue and describe how it's different from the political issue, and then to kind of present all the arguments. It's what great writing does. It's what great historians do. And it's what we've got to do as we continue to inspire people to learn about history.
You mentioned how the Constitution Center has live interactive classes on the Constitution that are specifically targeted at students, but also people of all ages. And you often have seeing legal scholars and advocates on there. How do you make sure that these topics stay digestible, but also comprehensive and cover everything that students need to know?
Well, we pick topics either that are in the news, which we think, you know, we all want to learn about, or from history. And we try to get scholars who are really good storytellers who can make things digestible. And then we try to tailor the conversation to our different audiences. So we'd have different questions for middle and high school students, perhaps, than on the podcast. Later today, I'm recording our Friday class. It's with Professor Kwame Jeffries, who's a wonderful scholar. It's about the civil rights movement in honor of MLK Week. And we'll focus on great heroes of the civil rights movement from his book. And that's a great way to tell those stories, just by asking about the people, who men and women who fought for civil rights. If we were I think we'll do a podcast on an MLK speech next week. We're just programming it right now, and we'll get scholars who can help us parse the text. And that might involve less storytelling and more what philosophers did. Martin Luther King read when he wrote the letter from the Birmingham jail. What was the relationship between his vision of universal Christian love and the Greek version of agape, or universal benevolence? How did that relate to the founders' moral vision and so forth? It's going to be really exciting to explore all those issues. So obviously you can go into things at a different level based on the audience, but basically my creed is that learners of all ages are able to dig in really deeply if they are excited by great teaching and led through the various steps. So I have faith that people starting in middle school can go pretty deep into these issues. And that's why I'm so excited and not at all surprised that you and your colleagues on the High School SCOTUS blog are going so deeply as well.
So you've talked a lot about the amazing work that you do at the National Constitution Center. And our next question is a little bit more tricky, but what do you think are the limitations of the work that you do at the National Constitution Center?
Well, it will not reach everyone. There is an assumption among some that, you know, okay, it's great to reach all the people we're reaching, but it should be not just 250,000 students, but all, you know, 10 million students in America, or everyone should know about this stuff, or we need to solve the civics problem. And we've all heard those statistics about how, at least until recently, the numbers are a little better now, but a third of Americans couldn't name a single branch of government, and only a third could name all three. You know, the civic knowledge is really distressing. I have to say, realistically, I don't think that the National Constitution Center or any organization by itself can solve the civics problem, because the civics problem is related to deeper challenges involving education in America, which involve questions of equity and equality and access, and also involve questions of attention and distraction and social media and, you know, people not learning. And ultimately, because they're spending too much time on their phones. And that's in addition to the equity and access problems, that afflicts, as we've been discussing, even the most privileged students and adults. So those are all, and then there's the problem of political polarization in America, which is extremely serious, and which no institution or organization is going to solve. Those divisions are real. So I think we need to be both very ambitious and full of positivity, but also realistic about what any organization or movement or group can or can't do. We can't solve the polarization problem in America. We can't solve the attention span problem in America. We're not going to end all of the structural inequalities in America, but we can shed a whole lot of light. And by holding forth a beacon for learning and light for those who are eager to kindle to it, we can just change people's lives. I mean, as we've been discussing, my life was changed by a couple of great teachers. Yours were too, I think, are being changed by those great teachers. just by holding forth a vision of great teaching and learning, we're going to change a whole lot of people's lives, and the numbers will grow, and hopefully they'll grow bigger and bigger. And hopefully it's going to make such a difference that the Republic will survive, because the founders were right that unless citizens take the time to educate themselves, they can't be forced to do it. They can't be, you know, coerced into doing it. People have to be inspired one by one to be learners. And hopefully we can do that. And it's literally going student by student. There's a beautiful James Thompson poem that Abigail Adams loved to quote about the shooting of the individual mind, the tender spring that would be kindled by learning, teaching the tender mind to shoot. And that's kind of what we're doing one by one. And that's the limitation, and that's the opportunity.
This might be an unsolvable issue, but it's something I've been thinking about a lot, in that Hannah and I are both very privileged. And so we have access to often the Constitution and to the legal researching and understanding the legal issues of our time. And we have teachers that will support us in that. Does it worry you that education around the Constitution can be a very privileged thing and something that can be divided by the inequities in our society as well?
Well, yes, educational inequities are very serious, and teachers make all the difference. It really is all about the teachers. A single great teacher can change our lives. And if you don't, you're not lucky enough to have access to great teachers, then it's a great inequality. However, I am so heartened and have seen from experience that we see great teachers and great learners in all settings, including in less privileged settings. My sons are in high school in Washington, D.C. They go to public school in Washington, D.C., and they've had some phenomenal teachers in those schools, including about the Constitution. And the other great benefit is that all this material is now free and online. So a big answer to the educational inequities is that it's possible for teachers who want it to get this great material for free. This in no way denies the seriousness of the structural inequalities in education. And there's no doubt that some privileged people have access to greater resources and greater teachers than others. And a big part of our job has to be to help get this material not only offered to, but adopted by folks who are less privileged. But the opportunity is there because of the web, and I'm confident that we'll be able to make a difference.
That's incredible. So speaking about students more broadly, why is it so important for students to be in touch with the Supreme Court and the impact of its decisions on their own rights?
Because it will directly affect their lives. Every issue in our lives involving politics nowadays is going before the Supreme Court, from issues involving, we know, the most controversial ones, voting rights, which is so important to citizenship, the right to bear arms, reproductive choice, affirmative action, the question of the ability of the government to regulate health and safety, which we saw yesterday with the COVID vaccine. How can you understand what your rights are? And how can you defend your rights unless you study the Supreme Court? The framers talked again and again about the need for virtue in citizens. And by virtue, they meant the ability to be ruled by reason, self-mastery, the self-discipline to be your best self so that you could serve others. And education, so you could cultivate your faculties of reason, was crucial to that. And the main reason that was so important immediately is unless people took the time to learn about their rights, they wouldn't defend them. And they might be misled by demagogues of the kind that led to the fall of the empires of Rome and that led to the collapse of democracy and liberty. Silver-tongued demagogues could mislead the people by promising them luxuries and appealing to their greed and avarice as they took away their liberties, as Caesar did. That was a model that came up a lot during the founding. And I think we've, you know, I'll be nonpartisan here because the threat comes from all sides. This isn't limited to one candidate or one party, but we see today threats of demagogues of all stripes who are also promising to offer people immediate gratification while taking away liberty. And it's very important to resist that. And you can't resist it unless you know about history and unless you recognize the threat and unless you're willing to defend constitutional structures and institutions that will protect liberty, including, among other things, the independence of the judiciary, which is crucial to defending liberty. So one reason that it's important, you ask, why should we study the Supreme Court? It's important to study it not only because we understand what it says, but also we understand why it's so important what it does and why judges need to be free to reach independent judgments and to strike down laws that could be popular or to reach decisions that are unpopular, and why judicial independence is so crucially important if liberty is going to prevail. People who know about history and the Constitution are more likely to support judicial independence than those who don't. And that's another thing that's really important. And if this all sounds like, you know, a kind of bland moralizing or you know, preaching for civics, it's not, because there's a lot of serious talk by people on all sides of the spectrum about civil unrest. We saw what happened on January 6th. And even some folks wondering about whether America's so divided, we might be face the threat of a new, you know, civil division, or if not a civil war, a kind of a new period of violence that would involve great sectarian divisions. So these are very serious issues. And one important way of meeting the threat is to defend the independent institutions, from the judiciary to the proper adjudication of election results to the nonpartisan institutions responsible for making decisions about the processes of government that make our liberties possible. That's why the stakes are so high.
Very sobering, but I do think everything that's going on in our country does make students more cognizant of their rights and their future and what they're inheriting. If students wanted a first taste of the Supreme Court and how it intersects with specifically their rights as students in the schoolhouse, and what is a case that, or a few cases that they should look into that really will help them understand that?
Well, the BL case, BL, which was this Snapchat cheerleader case from last year, is a great place to start, because that involves something that every student can understand. Do I have the right to curse on Snapchat or to say stuff online that the school might not like without getting punished? And in that case, the Supreme Court unanimously said, yes, the cheerleader did have the right to say, use an epithet when she was disappointed she didn't make the team on Snapchat, because that was not school-related speech and it didn't run the risk of creating a substantial disruption in the school. But although the case was unanimous, the justices were divided about the reasoning. And it's interesting to compare the reasoning of the lower, which held that any off-campus speech should be protected, that basically you have to be either speaking on campus or on online platforms related to the school in order to be punished. And the U.S. Supreme Court, which took a more pragmatic, balanced kind of view, and said that generally off-campus speech should be protected, but things could be different. And the main thing was to protect the democratic interest in having access to different points of view. Students can decide for themselves if they think that I'll call it a more pragmatic line, makes sense, or whether it runs the risk, you know, in an age where so much of our lives are online, that it would lead to the suppression of a lot of off-campus speech. We'll be seeing a lot of other cases moving forward. Obviously, this is very important to all of us, to students and adults too. What can I say on social media? Can my school punish me? Can my employer punish me? What's the difference between my rights as an employee, as a young adult, and my rights as a student? Should they be different? And so forth. These are very hard questions. There's no easy answer from the case law. There are principles that are important. I was interviewing Judge Cheryl Krause, who wrote the Third Circuit opinion, the lower court decision on the case just last Friday. And I asked her why it was important to protect off-campus speech. And she gave very eloquent reasons. And we quoted together from John Milton's Areopagitica, which is one of the great defenses of free speech ever written. It's so exciting and beautiful. And I hope listeners will check it out. But Milton is imagining a world of where you have to get a license to publish a book. This is the 17th century, and there's a lot of religious wars going on. And he said, well, what's going to happen if you have to have a license for every book? There's so many books published, you'd have to have hundreds of licensors reading every word. You're going to have to train people to do this. But obviously, good people are not going to want to do this because it's so arduous. And then it's not going to stop there. If we start licensing books, then you'll have to have licensors for what music you can listen to or when you can dance. And boys and girls or men and women who want to talk to each other are going to have their conversations regulated. And a licensor is going to have to decide whether or not that's appropriate. And this will prevent the whole point of free speech, which is to allow truth to grapple with error, and will put in the hands of some musty censor the right to decide what we say and speak and sing and dance, and will be a great threat to liberty. Milton's words are far more beautiful than my summary of them. But wow, he just anticipated the age of Facebook and Twitter, where they actually are hiring tens of, thousands of, they call them content monitors around the world to kind of read our speech and figure out what violates the terms of service and what doesn't. And Milton anticipated it all. So that's a great place to begin. And there's so much more.
One of our final questions is that every day you teach students about the Constitution and the court. But we're curious, what have you learned from the students that you speak with?
Oh my goodness. I learn every single time I teach. Leonard Bernstein was a great genius of 20th century music, was also one of the greatest teachers of music of the 20th century. And in one of his great videos about music, which folks can find on YouTube and learn so much from, he notes that the German word for teacher is Lerner, is learner. And to be a teacher and a learner is the same thing. I learned from my students at GW when we were talking about the abortion cases this term, new and powerful arguments for protecting the rights of reproductive choice as a matter of women's equality rather than the right to privacy that I hadn't heard articulated before and which were being worked out by the students. I learned in the Friday classes about why free speech is important in school. I learned from the questions about what aspects of constitutional history resonates and what doesn't. I think of teaching as learning, and it's a conversation. And there's a beautiful phrase that Justice Holmes always used. The Constitution is made for people of fundamentally differing points of view. And you can't teach the Constitution without listening to people of differing points of view. And that includes students of all ages. And you young people who represent the future also understand much better than I do how these issues are being worked in school and in life, because you are living them in a way that older folks like I cannot. So we can learn so much from each other. Really, the best thing the Constitution Center can do, and that I have the privilege of doing, is just hosting the conversations, having a civil platform for people to listen to different points of view, for everyone to have their say, and to make up their own minds. And that's why we're learning together. Come, let us learn together. Come, let us reason together is a phrase from the book of Isaiah that one of my heroes, Justice Louis Brandeis, loved to quote. And that's one of our mottos at the Constitution Center. And it's such a meaningful enterprise to reason with all of you.
We just spoke with Jeffrey Rosen, the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us. We couldn't be more excited to launch this podcast, and we hope you'll join us on our journey to explore the Constitution, the Supreme Court, and the rights of students. Subscribe to our podcast, get our next episode directly in your feed, and while you're there, drop us a rating or review. Make sure to come back in 2 weeks for an episode on free speech at school.
And for more coverage of the Supreme Court by teenagers, check out the High School SCOTUS website at highschoolscotus.com. On the blog, you can read oral argument previews, opinion analysis, and interviews with eminent legal scholars. Everything you need to stay in touch with the court. That's highschoolscotus.com. We can't wait to see you next time.